Welcome to the podcast, Tis But a Scratch, Fact and Fiction about the Middle Ages. I'm your host, Professor Richard Abels. Today we will be talking about England's most famous saint and martyr. No, not St. Thomas More, a different St. Thomas, Thomas Becket. I am delighted to have back as my co-host, a veteran of the podcast, Dr. Jennifer Paxton of the Catholic University of America. That seems pretty appropriate for something on Becket, doesn't it?
It really does, and I'm just delighted to be back.
In earlier episodes, Jenny and I discussed King Arthur and Robin Hood. The subject of today's episode is another famous name from English medieval history and popular culture, and this individual, we can at least safely say, was an actual historical figure.
Yes, he really did live. When I gave a talk on St. Thomas at the Smithsonian some years ago, I began it with a poem that at least some of our audience will find familiar.
When that April with his sure sorta, the drucht of March hath persed to the rota, and bathed every vine in switch liqueur, of which vertu engendered is the floor. When Zephyrus ache with his sweet a breath, in spirit hath in every halt and heath the tendra croppers, and the younger sunna hath in the ram his half a course runna, and small a foolers marken melodia, that sleep in all the nicht with open ear, so pricketh him nature in her courages, than longend folk to go on pilgrimages, and palmers for to seeken stranger strandes to ferne halwas, cooth in sundry londes. And specially from every shearer's ender of England to Canterbury they went, the holy, blissful martyr for to seeker that him hath holpen when that they were seeker. And pilgrims were they alle that toward Canterbury Walden reader.
I first memorized these lines in fourth grade. Thank you, Miss Osborne.
Fourth grade? She must have been one of the most demanding elementary school teachers in the history of the world.
For which I am grateful. It is partly her fault that I am a medievalist.
Well, we should be grateful to her then.
Thank you. The audio clip is, of course, the famous prologue to Sir Geoffrey Chaucer's Canterbury Tales. And I want us everybody to notice something about the text. First of all, Chaucer takes a really long time to say, in April, when it rains a lot and spring has begun.
Yeah.
But Neville Coghill does it very beautifully. Second, what do we learn about the reason people go on pilgrimage? Why do they go to Canterbury? I see a hand going up.
Prof, I know the reason. It's to visit the tomb of a holy martyr who has helped them when they were sick, right?
Good. And who is this holy martyr? I see the same hands going up. Okay, Richard.
It's Thomas Becket.
Yes, but how did you know that?
I just knew it.
Right? Because you can't tell from the text. You just have to know. The point here is that Becket was so famous in medieval England that you didn't even need to name check him. Just mentioning Canterbury and Holy Martyr is enough. So how do we get to this state of affairs?
Well, for me, as well as many Americans of my generation, and for those who didn't have Miss Osborne in fourth grade, Thomas Becket is probably best known from the 1964 movie Becket, starring Richard Burton in the title role and Peter O'Toole in his first of two portrayals as King Henry II.
4 years later, he was Henry II again, but this time an older Henry II in The Lion in Winter.
Which I really liked.
It's a really fun movie. He was nominated for Best Actor for both roles, which may say something about Henry II as well as Peter O'Toole.
But it's Peter O'Toole's performance in The Lion in Winter that really sticks with me. I'm a bit embarrassed to say it, but it probably helped shape my idea of Henry II, just as I can't think of King John without imagining Claude Rains in The Adventures of Robin Hood. I'm going to play a brief clip from the 1964 movie Becket. The year in the film is 1162. King Henry II of England is campaigning in France, and he is accompanied by his close friend and chancellor, that's his right-hand man, Thomas Becket. Word arrives that the Archbishop of Canterbury has died, and a replacement must be found. And then the king has a brilliant idea.
An extraordinary idea is creeping into my mind. my royal edict nominating you, Thomas Becket, Primate of England, Archbishop of Canterbury.
I beg of you, do not do this.
You've never disappointed me, Thomas. And you're the only man I can trust.
Becket had never disappointed him before, but there's always a first time. After all, Becket had never been Archbishop of Canterbury before.
This has got to be one of the worst hires in history.
Spoiler alert, it doesn't turn out well.
On December 29th, 1170, four royal knights confronted Archbishop Thomas Becket in his own cathedral at Canterbury and cut him down at his prayers. They were supposedly acting in response to their exasperated king, who had cried out,
"Will no one rid me of this meddlesome priest? A priest who mocks me. Are all around me cowards? Are there no men left in England?
I hate to ruin a great story and even a better historical quotation, but it's unlikely that Henry II said this, or even a variation on it. We owe the exasperated king's cry, "Who will rid me of this meddlesome or turbulent priest?" to a mid-18th century British bookseller and writer, Robert Dodsley. It was popularized a few decades later and fixed into the popular mind by George Littleton. And I have to confess that I owe this nugget to Wikipedia. Yes, Wikipedia. After telling students for years not to rely on it, I've gradually become a believer, especially when it comes to obscure topics.
You still need to use it cautiously. Wikipedia entries are only as good as the secondary sources cited, and those can be uneven. But it's good on basic facts.
Okay, you're absolutely right. Though I love the description of Wikipedia as a concept that only works in practice, never in theory. But we'll come back to the question of King Henry II's complicity in the murder of Thomas Becket in the second half of this two-part series.
So in these two episodes, Richard and I will tell the story of how this blissful holy martyr was made and how that martyr's story has resonated down through the ages for over 800 years in very different ways.
So how do you think we should do this?
Well, first, I think we should spend some time setting the scene for Becket's life and career. And then we're going to pay plenty of attention to the showdown between king and archbishop.
Yeah, because that is the key moment. In particular, I'm interested in exploring the issue that drove a wedge between King Henry II and the man he first named to the position of chancellor and then raised up to the position of Archbishop of Canterbury.
Whether royal courts have a right to try and punish clergy accused of having committed secular crimes, or whether clergy, as members of a supranational state, have clerical immunity and are only subject to canon law, that's basically what's at the crux of this.
What I love is that the church by this time, by the mid-12th century, is both a supranational state and a supernatural state.
I like that. That's great,
yeah.
Richard.
Yeah. The position that the church took, that its clergy was immune from the prosecution for crimes because they did not belong to the state, sort of like a diplomatic immunity, a clerical immunity, is an explanation for the modern church's problematic response to accusations of pedophilia against clergy.
Well, they've cleaned it up a lot, but they really had to get over the question of treating priests as only subject to canon law. They had to come to the point where they realized that it was impossible not to interact directly with the secular law.
Yeah. And it's interesting because the church in the 12th century was saying that clergy needed to be disciplined for sin, and that what the state regarded as crimes, the church was regarding as sin. It's an interesting problem. Where exactly the border between sin and crime occurs.
Absolutely. And this is a period when distinctions between church and state don't fall along the lines that we're familiar with now. So it's really, they're so interpenetrated that it's hard to tease them apart.
I totally agree. 11th and 12th century rulers, kings like Henry II or Frederick Barbarossa of Germany, regarded the church as their church. They regarded themselves as the head not only of the secular realm, but of also the spiritual realm. The papacy disagreed. As Archbishop of Canterbury, Thomas Becket was caught in this paradigm shift, and it led to his martyrdom. Today's episode is going to take us down to the consecration of Thomas as Archbishop of Canterbury. Most of this episode will, in fact, provide historical context about developments in church and state in England following the disastrous civil war between Stephen and Matilda. The follow-on episode will explore the quarrel between Thomas Becket and King Henry II, the quarrel that led to Becket's exile, and after his return from exile, his death at the hands of four knights dispatched from the court of Henry II in France. Okay, once we do have our martyr in the second episode, then what next should we do?
We're going to talk then about how the cult of St. Thomas was established and how it resonated both in England and beyond. And then we're going to turn to the most famous literary manifestations of the cult of St. Thomas, the Canterbury Tales, of course, and the plays of two 20th century authors, T.S. Eliot's Murder in the Cathedral from 1951 and Jean Anouilh's French play Becket from 1959.
And the movie was based upon Jean Anouilh's play, and Jean Anouilh is credited as one of the screenplay writers for it. And as I think I told you, there is also a 1951 really stagey movie production of T.S. Eliot's Murder in the Cathedral, a much more modest production. And interestingly, T.S. Eliot is credited also as one of the two screenplay writers for that film. So we have a plan of action.
Along the way, I hope we're going to be able to convey something of the eternal fascination of this deeply polarizing man. People have always had strong opinions about him, both during his lifetime and ever since. Some people thought he was a hero, defending the rights of the church. Others thought he was causing a lot of unnecessary trouble. For example, one of his chief enemies, the very prolific and savvy Bishop of London, Gilbert Folliot, he once said of Becket, "You're a fool, Thomas, and you'll always be a fool." And Becket has his detractors even today. My medieval English history professor at Yale, Dr. Robert Stacey, who later served as Dean of Arts and Sciences at the University of Washington at Seattle, and is the respected author of numerous scholarly works and textbooks.
Yep, he is.
He's fantastic. He refused to lecture about Becket because he felt that he could not be rational on the subject. He loathed Becket so much. And I promise you, this is an otherwise deeply rational man.
On the other hand, Becket has had his fervent adherents. In my first full teaching position, which was as a visiting assistant professor at Cornell College, the other Cornell, Cornell College in Mount Vernon, Iowa, I had a classroom encounter with a student about Becket that left me speechless, a condition I assure you is not natural for me. I was the sabbatical replacement for the school's medieval historian, Dr. Bill Carroll, who is the type of eccentric who can be found in some small liberal arts schools. Carroll had originally been hired as historian of the British Empire, but along the way he had fallen in love with the Middle Ages. Rather, he had fallen in love with medieval Christianity, which he embraced as truth. So he had a dual conversion, spiritually to Lefebvre Catholicism and academically to medieval history.
Wait, what? He was a follower of Archbishop Lefebvre, one of these guys who rejected Vatican II, a sede vacantist, as we call it?
Yes. Yes, that Archbishop Marcel Lefebvre, who was excommunicated as a schismatic for being more Catholic than the Pope. Dr. Carroll was firmly convinced that the pinnacle of all human knowledge and wisdom was in the writings of St. Thomas Aquinas. His Western Civ course treated Renaissance humanism as a wrong turn and the Enlightenment as the crumbling of the spiritual foundations of Western civilization. He had a small coterie of students who followed him about campus and might be best described as his disciples. They, of course, had also embraced Lefebvreite, pre-Vatican II version of Catholicism,
much to the puzzlement of the local parish priest.
He had instructed all of them to take whatever medieval courses I offered, which was, for the most part, nice, because it meant that I had full classes, and it also meant that I had serious students. One of those courses, however, was Law and Society of Medieval England. I had given the class readings on the Becket controversy. After outlining the positions of King Henry II and Becket in as neutral a way as I possibly could, I asked the class which men did they believe to have been right. And this was to begin a class discussion. One student immediately raised his hand and said, St. Thomas. Good, I said. Now explain why you conclude that. He looked at me and said, he obviously was right because he's a saint.
How did you respond to that?
I was at a loss. This was not what I expected. And I paused. I thought I paused for an hour, but it was probably only a few seconds. And I finally said, I'd like to explain the difference between history and theology.
So what made Becket such a lightning rod for controversy? Before we answer that question, we need to set the scene. So let's start with some family history. And then we're going to see right away that Becket's life and career bring out some of the most important developments in English history in the 12th century.
Thomas Becket was born anywhere between 1118 and 1120. We just don't have the good enough records on that. He was the son of a London merchant named Gilbert Becket and his wife Matilda, and they were Norman immigrants from the city of Rouen.
He was not a Saxon, as he was made out to be in the movie Becket.
Yeah. The idea of an ongoing Norman oppression of Saxons in the centuries following the Norman conquest, the so-called Norman yoke, is pretty much a historical myth invented by 17th century antiquarians and jurists who sought the origins of Parliament and English liberty in the pre-conquest past. It was popularized by Sir Walter Scott in the early 19th century in his novel Ivanhoe and became a trope in movies about Robin Hood. Norman encroachment upon the rights and property of English landowners was a very real thing in the decades following the Battle of Hastings, but any ethnic distinction had been replaced by the 12th century by distinctions of class, though most peasants probably spoke English, and the aristocracy, regardless of their ancestry, spoke French.
Anyway, we know that Becket was of relatively humble social status. I'm not talking in terms of wealth. He wasn't impoverished, but he was not connected. He wasn't noble. The name Becket, it's not exactly an aristocratic name.
No, it certainly isn't. It comes from the word for beak.
Beak.
And it might actually be a reference to an inherited tendency in the family to have what we would call an aquiline or eagle-like nose.
Yeah.
So kind of a prominent nose. And Becket is known to have had this nose from contemporary description. So Thomas Beaky Nose is not in the same league with a name like, say, Roger de Pont-l'Évêque, who would be named Archbishop of York while Becket was Archbishop of Canterbury. And Becket never liked the name Becket, and he never used it in writings or on his episcopal seal. And we know that other people were aware of Becket's sensitivity about his name because his murderer supposedly referred to him pointedly as Becket in order to goad him.
Yeah. The important point about this is that Becket's family and his sensitivity to the name speaks to something fundamental about his experience. He was a social upstart and he knew it.
And it probably explains why, after he had gained the king's favor, why he dressed extravagantly and made a show of his wealth. He was insecure enough that he really wanted to be sure that people knew he had arrived.
Yeah, nouveau riche. And that seems to have amused Henry II and the nobles of his court. Becket's friend and subdeacon, William Fitzstephen, wrote a biography of the martyred archbishop.
Several of Becket's household clerics and friends did. I think he had has the most biographies of anybody in the nobles.
Yeah, it really is remarkable how many of Becket's household clerics took a shot at writing a biography of him in the decades following his martyrdom.
Yeah. Now, William Fitzstephen's biography was meant to emphasize Becket's piety and goodness. After all, he's a martyr. So it's really telling that he included an anecdote about a joke played on Becket by King Henry II. He tells us that the king, Becket, and some royal courtiers were riding in London on a particularly cold winter day. The king and Becket, riding ahead of the others, saw an old man walking toward them dressed in a thin and ragged coat. The king pointed the man out to Becket and said, "Wouldn't it be an act of charity to give him a thick, warm cloak?" Becket readily agreed and said the king should do that immediately. Becket believed that Henry would order one of the household knights to get the man a cloak. When the old man drew near, the king called out to him, asking if he would like to have a good coat. The old man thought they were joking, and Henry was joking, but the joke was on Becket. Henry turned to Thomas and said, "You shall have the credit for this act of charity," and immediately tried to pull Becket's cape off of him. He grabbed him by the hood and started to tug. Now, William Fitzstephen noted that this was a new and very good cape. It was scarlet and gray, and Becket didn't want to lose it. So Becket kept on pulling back, and the knights and the great men of the retinue saw the king and the chancellor on horseback apparently wrestling with each other until finally Becket gave up. The cloak came off, and Henry threw the cloak down to the old man, who, amazed at his good luck, scurried away with it, giving thanks to God. According to William Fitzstephen, he should have given thanks to Henry II. The king explained to the others what he had done, and everyone laughed, and then some of the knights offered Becket a coat.
There is a lot to unpack in this story, and I'm sure we will do that when we talk about Becket's relationship with Henry. I'm not surprised, however, that Becket appreciated a fine cloak. His parents were merchants, possibly in the cloth trade, but they prospered. London was a boom town in this period, and immigrants from Normandy were definitely making good. His neighborhood, Cheapside, was full of such immigrants.
It's worth pointing out that Cheapside derives from the Old English word cheap, which means a market, a trade, a bargain, and that a cheapman was a merchant, was a trader. So Cheapside is where the merchants hang out. And of course, we get our word cheap from it.
Right, right. So they lived alongside native merchants as well. So Becket would have grown up speaking French at home with his parents, but he would have learned English from his family servants and from his neighbors. So it's a multilingual environment. And he probably acquired Latin beginning in childhood from local priests. But he later went away to boarding school at an Augustinian abbey, which is a sign that his parents were fairly well-to-do.
Yeah.
And in fact, we have later evidence that his childhood home was quite substantial in size. So they were also well enough off to fund a year of study in Paris when Becket was about 18, sort of like a year abroad, a sure sign that the family intended him from some sort of higher order career in a prominent household, either in the church or in the state. And in fact, Becket ended up moving back and forth between church and state throughout his career, and that was pretty common in the 12th century. So the Becketts socialized with some well-connected men, even though they were not of the nobility. And it was probably through family friends that he first came to the notice of the man who would give him his first big break.
And that was Theobald of Bec, the Archbishop of Canterbury. Theobald gave Thomas a job in his household in around 1143, when Becket was probably in his early 20s. Thomas steadily worked his way up the ladder in the archbishop's circle, and by 1154, when he was in his early 30s, he was named Archdeacon of Canterbury, which made him the archbishop's right-hand man. Archdeacons in the 12th century were the assistants of bishops. Bishops were very, very busy men, and archdeacons were delegated many responsibilities. They might represent the bishop at a council if he couldn't attend. They would punish priests who committed spiritual or criminal offenses. And probably most importantly, they oversaw the bishop's finances and expenditures, including the collection of revenues from the tenants on the bishop's estates. Needless to say, archdeacons in the 12th and 13th centuries were reviled as a group both by other clerics and by laymen.
We were saying earlier that sort of like the vice principal, these are the people who have to do the dirty work, essentially, of running the place.
Or in the Middle Ages, the seneschals of comital and royal courts.
Exactly. Very much a parallel case. And it's also important to keep in mind that Becket spent more than a decade working in a deeply clerical atmosphere, surrounded by very smart, very well-educated, and in some cases, very holy men. When we come to consider his supposedly dramatic conversion at the time that he became archbishop, we should remember that going to Canterbury as archbishop was actually a kind of homecoming for him.
Yes. But episcopal households were, like those of kings and counts, filled with competitive young men. Thomas' success incurred the jealousy of others in the archbishop's household, most notably Roger of Pont-l'Evêque, the future Archbishop of York. That was a rivalry that lasted a lifetime, at least it lasted Thomas's lifetime, and may have led to Thomas's death.
But we are getting ahead of ourselves. We keep jumping ahead to his murder. It's almost impossible not to be thinking about it all the time. So Theobald was Archbishop of Canterbury during a turbulent period in English history, the civil war between King Stephen and his cousin, the Empress Matilda. He had been named archbishop by King Stephen and was loyal to him in his dispute with Matilda. But this was also a period in which the papacy was increasingly exerting its authority over the clergy, in particular over bishops. And when the papacy and the crown came into conflict, Theobald remained loyal to the pope. As a result, he went into exile twice, in 1148 and again in 1152. The first time for attending a council called by the papal legate against the orders of the king, the second for refusing to crown Stephen's son Eustace king against the orders of the pope. And these sorts of precedents are definitely going to figure into what happens later with Thomas Becket. Both of these exiles by Archbishop Theobald were brief. In 1153, Matilda's son Henry invaded England. The death of Eustace in the same year led to a peace settlement, that Stephen would remain king until his death, but then he would be succeeded by Henry.
Yes. So, okay, now for a quick, hopefully quick, overview of King Henry II's reign and accomplishments. For many modern historians, in particular institutional historians, Henry II was England's greatest medieval king. I would say that his only real rival for that title is King Edward I, but personally, I would give Henry II the nod. And this is because of Henry II's contribution to the development of English common law. So, who was this man? Who was Henry II?
First of all, he wasn't English.
No.
He was the son of Count Geoffrey Plantagenet, the Count of Anjou, and of the Empress Matilda, who was the daughter of King Henry I of England. She was also the widow of the Emperor Henry V, and she kept on calling herself the Empress even when she was in England.
Why would you not?
Why would you not? As we've said, Henry assumed the throne of England after a generation of civil war, which lasted from 1137 or 1138 to 1153. And that civil war was between his uncle, King Stephen of Blois, and his mother. By inheritance, Henry II was King of England, Duke of Normandy, and Count of Anjou. Historians have traditionally termed Henry II's holdings as the Angevin Empire, although it really wasn't an empire. And Angevin is the adjectival form of Anjou in medieval Latin. This is not a contemporary term, but it's one coined by historians, so we're going to use it. The only medieval empire in the West at that time was the German-Italian Holy Roman Empire.
Well, in addition to these other holdings, through his marriage to Eleanor of Aquitaine in 1152, Henry also held the Duchy of Aquitaine.
And the Duchy of Aquitaine was enormous, at least in terms of what it claimed as its overlordship, because it included also Languedoc as well as Aquitaine. So what did this marriage do for Henry? It brought him international prestige. It brought him all this land.
And the marriage was a poke in the eye to Henry's overlord for his French possessions, King Louis VII of France, to whom Eleanor had been previously married. Louis had had his marriage to Eleanor annulled, but he was reluctant to give up his claims to her duchy and was especially unhappy that she had agreed to marry a man who already held more geographical territory in France than he did.
Yes, who had gotten divorced on the grounds of consanguinity.
Yeah, the medieval get-out-of-marriage free card.
Which they kind of only figured out after two daughters had been born.
And yeah, and Louis VII desperately wanted his son.
Why does that remind me of something in later English history?
Right.
Oh,
right.
Well, yeah. Never mind.
Okay, so by the time of his death in 1189... Henry's dominions and overlordship would include England, Ireland, and the western half of France. The King of France's domain, in comparison, was a territory about the size of Vermont, extending from a little north of Paris to Orléans.
Yeah. Henry II, as I said, is considered one of England's greatest kings by modern historians due to his judicial reforms and legal innovations. His most important contribution to English governance was to increase the king's financial and judicial rights over his free subjects. Henry II and his counselors advanced a doctrine of royal liege lordship that asserted that the king is the primary lord of all free Englishmen, whosoever their immediate lord might be, and that the king is the ultimate source of all landed property. Henry's basic policy in England was to increase the power of the crown over his lay and his ecclesiastical barons, or as he put it, to recapture the royal powers and customs that had belonged to his grandfather, King Henry I, which the barons had usurped during the anarchy. Henry II's innovative mind led him to expand English common law, the royal law that is binding upon all free men.
When Archbishop Theobald anointed Henry King of England in 1154, England was a royal mess.
Yeah.
During the anarchy, private castles had sprung up all through England. Henry ordered that all of these castles be, quote-unquote, justified by license of the crown, or they would be confiscated or destroyed. If he deemed a castle to be dangerous, he disregarded whether the castellan had a proper franchise or not. He also appointed his own followers to royal offices, ignoring claims of those who had held these offices prior to his accession.
Henry's long-term domestic policy was he used his feudal prerogatives as king to increase royal revenues, extend royal justice over all freemen in England so that it would become, in fact, the common law of the realm, and to strengthen the crown's military power by relying on mercenaries rather than feudal levies.
This wasn't very popular with his barons. It's not so much that they and their knights were itching to fight, but the barons resented that Henry insisted upon taking from them a monetary payment in lieu of knight service, this is called scutage, without giving them the option of sending to his armies the knights that they owed as tenants-in-chief to the crown. It also shows that mercenaries were becoming a more valuable part of warfare than the knights owed from feudal quotas, a point that I've made in previous episodes.
So if we use domestic in a different sense, Henry's policy is to keep his four sons divided and guessing about their inheritance, and he also wanted to minimize the political authority of his wife, Eleanor, who was a very formidable figure in her own right.
Not a very good father or husband.
Really failed on both counts, if you ask me.
And this quote-unquote domestic policy threw a wrench into his long-term foreign policy, which was to maintain and increase control over his continental possessions and to minimize the rights and authority of his feudal overlord, the King of France, King Louis VII, and after him, King Philip II, Augustus of France. because they were able to play upon Henry's son's discontent to stir up familial rivalries and civil war.
That's the line in Winter.
Yeah.
So Henry is more successful in enacting his judicial reforms.
Yeah, he was. In a series of assizes, and that's royal councils, in which the king and his barons modify customary legal practices, in a series of these assizes, Henry translated his view of kingship into a royal legal system, the common law. That is, as I said before, royal law that extends to all free men in the realm. That's why it's common. Now, he didn't invent common law. It found its roots in the Anglo-Saxon past and in the legal reforms of Henry II's grandfather, King Henry I. Juries of free men in the localities were to be held responsible for indicting and trying criminals before itinerant royal justices. Disputes over the legal possession of land, which formerly had been heard in the private jurisdictional courts of barons, were now brought into royal courts presided over by royal judges. Judgments were decided by who had the evidence for rightful possession of the land, and that evidence was presented not to, but presented from juries of local men who knew the facts of the case.
Which is the total opposite of how we think
about
juries.
Yeah, we think of a jury as they decide. No, the jury were the witnesses who gave the evidence, and the judge then decided.
Because the point was you wanted to ask people who wouldn't
know
what happened.
Yeah.
Right. So one of the big problems during the Civil War had been that people who had problems with each other over land or some other issue had simply taken matters into their own hands and fought it out, since the king was too busy to help.
And they were all barons with their own castles and their own retinues.
Right, so you had a lot of little private wars. This is a self-help style of justice, and obviously it could lead to a lot of disorder in the countryside. There's lots of collateral damage.
Lots.
So it created these very long-standing feuds that could ripple down the social hierarchy from top to bottom. So you want to think about the servants slagging each other off in Romeo and Juliet. You would have that in the countryside everywhere.
It was a terrible time. The Civil War had basically messed up property rights throughout the realm. Orphan estates, as well as royal offices, had rival claimants.
They had been granted to them by Stephen, or they had been granted them by Matilda. And these lands had rival claimants who were able to point to a king or a queen having given them the right to the land. The question was, who really did have the right to these properties?
Henry's common law assizes were intended to disentangle these disputes and reestablish rightful title to land.
So Henry decided to do something about the disorder. He decided to make it more attractive for people to settle their disputes in the royal courts. And he did this by devising a series of standardized writs.
Wait, can you explain what a writ is?
Okay, so a writ is basically, you can sort of hear it in the name, it's a piece of writing that comes from the king that says, do this.
Yeah, and it's short and to the point.
They're very short most of the time.
And they're formulaic.
They're formulaic, and starting now they are.
Yeah. Okay?
In the past, they haven't been.
Now they are, okay.
Yeah. He did this, and he devised a series of standardized writs, that's the new part, and they gave people clear and guaranteed access to recognized procedures in the royal courts that would, at least in theory, be tailored to addressing whatever concern they had.
Yeah.
Now, you can get a writ if you happen to catch the king's attention, but the king is a moving target, and you had to find the king and lay out the specifics of your case to him, and then you would have to hope that he would grant you one of these writs, which, of course, you were going to have to pay for. And in the past, every writ would be different. It had to be drafted from scratch. So you would have to explain the story and what it is, and then the king would have to think, what do I want to say about this? And he would get his advisors to write it down. But what if the whole system could be streamlined? What if, instead of having to deal with each case individually, there could be a standard formula for the most common kinds of disputes? I mean, a sort of Form A and Form B that could be filled in whenever somebody showed up, whether the king was there in person or not. I mean, after all, some of these things just happen over and over again. That is exactly what Henry II's legal advisors came up with. They devised a series of standardized writs to address some of the most frequent kinds of legal disputes. And this lowered the cost of the writs. There was a kind of volume discount that could be applied. And it streamlined the whole process of getting the disputes dealt with. And we're going to talk about a couple of the most famous writs, but there were others.
Essentially, royal administration and justice was being transformed from ad hoc decisions to routine and formulaic procedures, and procedures that used the written record. The phrase "from ad hoc to routine" pretty much sums this up.
It really does.
Yeah. The most important writ that Henry II devised, at least the one that was used most often, was the writ of novel decision. Now, what does novel decision mean? It's not even a Latin term. It's really French, because that's the language still being spoken by the elite classes that were likely to be litigating with each other. The word novel means, unsurprisingly, new or recent. The word decision takes a little bit more explaining, because to understand what decision is, we have to understand what season is. Because decision means depriving someone of season. Now, season basically means possession. If you are in season of a particular piece of property, it means that you are holding it. You are actually in possession of it. It doesn't say anything about whether you have a right to hold the land. It merely means that you have it currently.
So if you've ever heard the expression, possession is 9/10 of the law, you get the idea. You're going to be in a much stronger position if you actually had season of the disputed property than if you didn't. So what the new writ of novel disseisin was designed to do was to stop people from taking this kind of advantage of their opponents in a land dispute. If someone had done this to you, that is, if someone had recently disseised you of your property, you could go to the king's court, get a writ of novel disseisin, for which you would pay a standard fee, and then you take it to the sheriff of the county, who was instructed in the writ to disseise the disseiser, so to speak. The sheriff would thus be restoring the status quo before the recent or novel disseisin, and then the case could be decided on the merits, to the extent that that was possible in the 12th century.
Which had another writ called the writ of right.
Exactly, the writ of right. There would still often have to be lengthy legal proceedings, which might or might not be terminated by a trial by battle to determine who actually had the right to the land, but at least order would have been restored, and you would take away that advantage somebody might get out of having possession.
And we're still in an era in which you have ordeals as a way of giving legal proof, and you have trial by combats, but increasingly, these are giving way to judgments from courts based upon evidence.
For obvious reasons.
Yeah. So, now let's say your father held an estate and his lord took possession of it when he died and refused to enfeoff you. Now, you could appeal to the king or to a royal justice to issue you what's called a writ of mort d'ancestor, which literally means a writ of the death of a ancestor. You would bring the writ to the sheriff, who would impanel a jury to physically view the contested property so that we all know what we're talking about. And that would be followed by a trial in front of a royal justice who decided the issue on the basis of the juror's answers to questions of fact. These questions were, one, did the previous holder hold in demesne as a fee this property? Two, is the claimant the nearest heir? If the juror said yes to both, the justice would order the sheriff to restore the property to you, and the wrongful claimant would then have to pay a fine. If the jury, however, said no, the justice would fine you for having made a false accusation. The writ was then, quote-unquote, returned to the justice by the sheriff, who would mark it as done and completed.
These writs proved enormously popular. They practically flew off the shelves, which gives you a sense of how much disseising was going on in England. It was clearly much cheaper to buy one of these writs than to hire your own gang of toughs to get rid of your opponent. Why not let the sheriff take care of that part? He had his own official gang of toughs.
Yeah, really. The writs were not only cheap, and obviously safer to use than self-help methods, but they also made people with property feel more secure. Property owners began to trust that if they held their land today, they would also be able to hold it tomorrow, and that the ultimate source of that sense of security was the law, specifically the king's law. This gave the propertied classes a stake in the established order, and that ultimately proved crucial to the development of English administrative government. What made these writs attractive to the king was that the law now became a secure source of royal revenue. Litigants had to pay the king to issue a writ for a case to be heard, and the losing party had to pay a fine to the crown. The king profited no matter who won. Henry II claimed the right to judge disputes not only between his own landed vassals, the tenants in chief of the realm, but between his vassals and their freemen. This swelled the royal coffers and took business away from feudal baronial courts. But the nobility saw the security that royal law provided for their possessions as a good trade-off. The proof of how completely the nobility bought into the new common law is that their only objection to it in Magna Carta, which is just a list of grievances against royal abuse, their only objection is that the king needs to hold courts more regularly, and in Article 18 reads, "Inquests of novel deceased, mort ancestor, and durand presentment shall be taken only in their proper county court. We ourselves, or in them meaning the king, we ourselves, or in our absence abroad, our chief justice will send two justices to each county 4 times a year, and these justices, with 4 knights of the county elected by the county itself, shall hold the assizes in the county court on the day and in the place where the court meets." In other words, regular form, right?
Right, and you also wanted them to be in a predictable place, not some faraway place that would be hard to get.
Yeah, that's a problem with peripatetic kingship.
It really is. So Henry is successful in having the crown's courts supersede the private baronial courts. He tried to do the same with ecclesiastical courts, but as we will see, he lost that battle.
Yeah, I think he was able to get away with his secular legal reforms, because the English aristocracy was exhausted after 15 years of civil war. When I was teaching Western Civ, it struck me that the willingness of the English barons to submit to the royal courts when it came to land law during the early years of Henry's reign isn't that different from the Roman aristocracy's willingness to turn power over to Augustus to basically give up their ancient liberty, because in both cases, the elites were tired of disorder and wanted a return to normalcy. And that could only be guaranteed by a strong executive power.
But they also obeyed because Henry II could inspire fear. Henry was, like many members of the Angevin family, hot-tempered.
Yeah.
Everybody knew about the famous Angevin temper. Henry could be given to almost ungovernable rages. He would throw himself to the ground and gnaw on the rushes. The rushes were plants that were strewn on medieval floors to absorb bits of food and other less pleasant items that might fall to the ground. And then they could be swept away, taking all the debris with them. So there's always something there on the ground for Henry to...
Apparently that was a family tradition. Henry's son, King John, also is described as having these royal fits. And I'm wondering, how much of this do you think is theatrical, and how much of this is just an emotional response?
Are you saying that kings engaged in performative anger?
Oh, well, when you put it that way, yeah, that's exactly what I'm saying.
But speaking of performative anger, I thought that Peter O'Toole was eating the scenery when he cried out, "Will nobody rid me of this meddlesome priest?" and then falls to the floor, gasping. But that might be historically accurate. He's just gnawing on the rushes.
Indeed. So Henry is a man to be reckoned with. A good friend, as long as he is your friend, but he's a very dangerous enemy.
And although it's a subject for a different episode, Henry II also was extremely canny in his use of the feudal prerogatives he had as king. These prerogatives were because he was the lord over these barons. Every lord could claim a payment called relief from the heir to a fief held from that lord.
It's basically a death tax.
Yeah, it's a death tax. The legal theory behind it is that a fief was not the property of the holder. It remained always the property of the lord who loaned it out. The payment of the relief was an acknowledgement of that. The size of the relief, how much money the relief would cost, was loosely defined by custom, but a lord could, if he wanted to, he could increase it. Henry II and his sons imposed extremely large reliefs upon their barons, but, and this is important for understanding Henry's approach to governing his nobles, Henry would initially only insist on a partial payment, with the remainder being recorded as debt in the pipe rolls of the exchequer, the royal treasury. If a baron or knight proved himself to be a loyal subject, Henry II would magnanimously forgive part or all the remaining debt. It was a way of rewarding service without costing the king anything.
And really, these debts that the king had on the books were used to terrorize the barons for many kings.
Yeah, because you could always call them in.
You could always do it, and they might hope that you would forgive it, but they could never be sure that you would.
It's holding the sword over their heads.
Absolutely. So by Henry's side, throughout all of these legal reforms we've been talking about, was his new chancellor, Thomas Becket.
Yes, we're back to Becket.
We are. But if Thomas did not owe his high position in the church to noble birth, which many bishops and archbishops in the Middle Ages certainly did, how did he get to the top of the clerical hierarchy of England? He wasn't rich or especially well-connected, at least to start with, and it's fair to say he wasn't exceptionally brilliant. Mm. In fact, he was constantly being outdone intellectually by men with more education than he had, people like John of Salisbury, who were definitely a cut above, intellectually speaking. Instead, he owed his phenomenal rise to charm, good looks, and sheer willpower.
You know, why are you looking at me when you said that?
I think what I was really thinking of is, in fact, Richard Burton.
Oh.
who I think is very, very well cast as Becket. So he's certainly dark-haired and handsome, just like Richard Burton was.
Yeah, yeah. And also, this is something I just realized when we started to do this, that Thomas was about 37 years old when he became Henry's chancellor. And that's the same age that Burton was when he made the film. On the other hand, Henry II at that time was only 22.
And that disparity in age is really very interesting. Becket had a magnetic fascination for people around him. And one of these is the young King Henry II. Henry took note of Becket early in his reign. At that time, Becket was a clerk in the household of Theobald, the Archbishop of Canterbury. Theobald wanted a man in the royal household, so he basically wants a voice in the household and also a set of ears. So the king made Becket his chancellor, and that is to say, the keeper of his records. It's a very powerful position, but even more than that, Henry made Becket his friend.
Yes.
As Richard said, Becket's about 15 years older than the king, but they seem to have a lot in common. They like to do the same kinds of things. They loved hunting and hawking and all sorts of athletic pursuits, and they enjoyed a good party.
Becket wasn't that great of a cleric, was he?
You know, one of the things that clerics always get accused of doing is getting involved in pursuits like hunting and hawking, which tells me that actually a lot of people did it.
Yeah.
We have accounts that the king and Becket spent lots of time together outside of what we could think of as business hours. A recent biography of Becket by a well-known historian of the Tudor period has cast doubt on this account of Becket's friendship with the king, since it's based largely on a single passage in the biography by William Fitzstephen, and that's only one of many Becket biographies, all of which were written after the murder. So how sure are we that this is true? But anyway, there's an obvious rhetorical point to be made by casting the story in tragic personal terms as the disastrous decline of a close friendship. That's very much the approach that Jean Anouilh takes in his play, Becket. In the film, makes some homoerotic suggestions that William Fitzstephen probably did not intend.
I've never been comfortable with this historian's parlor game of outing medieval figures. We simply don't know enough about any of their private lives and thoughts, and the language of affection of one era can sound erotic to the ears of those reading it in another era.
Basically, who knows, who cares?
Yeah, exactly.
We can leave the question of how close Becket and Henry were to each other aside, because there is plenty of drama in the events that we're absolutely sure about.
Yeah.
What we can say with certainty is that Becket, as Chancellor, proved himself to be a loyal and valuable royal agent. Officially, the Chancellor was a royal cleric in charge of the king's chaplains, and by extension of his writing office, because of course those are the people who can write
yes.
in the court. Becket, as Chancellor, oversaw the drafting of royal orders and diplomatic letters, which means he knows everything that's going on.
Yeah.
Henry's trust is shown by his use of Becket to negotiate the royal marriage between Henry's oldest son, Henry, who will later become the young king, and the French princess, Margaret. Becket arrived in the French court with 200 horsemen, 24 changes of clothes, silken cloths to be given as present, 8 wagons. 2 of the wagons were filled with English beer to give to the French. One wonders what they thought of that.
Yeah.
One held his chapel accoutrements. One was for the vessels of his chamber, one for the bursary, one for his kitchen stuff. And he had 12 pack horses with gold and silver plates, cups, and platters. The French court was impressed, and supposedly somebody said, "How marvelous must be the English king if his chancellor comes thus."
Which was the impression Becket wanted.
It was exactly what they wanted.
Yeah.
So Becket, as chancellor, did very well for himself. He seems to have accumulated some £30,000 in the 7 to 8 years that he was chancellor. And when he later was asked to account for it, he never did. Now, there might be reasons why he would refuse to do this, but one suspects that some of the money stuck to Becket as he went along the line.
And that probably was to be expected.
It was totally standard in the time.
Yeah, that's in lieu of wages.
Totally.
More remarkably, at least to me, is that Henry in 1159 had Becket command a military expedition to Toulouse. The Count of Toulouse was contesting King Henry's claim to overlordship over Languedoc in his capacity as Duke of Aquitaine. In the campaign, Becket, in full armor, led an army that included 700 knights. Now, that's a lot of knights.
It truly is.
And it must have also included several thousand foot soldiers. Despite being a novice at warfare, Becket managed to be successful. He captured 3 castles. Later, Becket fought in a border war between France and Normandy. Becket's success is either an example of a beginner's luck at warfare, or more likely, it's an example of his organizational skill and his leadership ability.
And he wasn't just a leader of men. He also fought himself. So he actually was engaged in a couple of instances in which he defended himself in arms. He wielded a sword.
As long as he didn't spill blood.
That's right. Now, once one wonders how that actually went down.
Yeah.
Now, it might seem weird to a modern audience that a cleric would lead an army, but that wasn't totally uncommon in the Middle Ages, because prelates were great landowners, and they served as royal officials. And although canon law technically forbade them from spilling blood, they weren't barred from commanding armies. A warrior bishop such as Archbishop Turpin in the Song of Roland is not just a figment of a poet's imagination.
And what I love about Turpin in the Song of Roland is that he's armed with a club. You can bash at somebody's head as long as you don't spill blood. It's a technical point, but it is.
One suspects so that if you hit somebody on the head with a club, yeah, you might spill a little blood.
It's collateral damage.
That's right. It wasn't what you intended to do.
Yes.
Okay.
As royal chancellor, Thomas Becket was a royal servant, and he seems to have placed that duty above his identity as a cleric. Conflict between the king and the churchmen of the realm was unavoidable. The church held maybe as much as 20%, maybe 25% of the land in England, and Henry's claim to adjudicate disputes over property impinged upon the church. What was to become even more critical was Henry II's claim to be judicially and jurisdictionally sovereign within his realm. The development of the papal monarchy and its claims to sovereignty over the clergy clashed with the royal claims. Henry II did not see his position as a novel imposition of royal authority, but the restoration of the good customs of the realm as practiced under his grandfather Henry I, and he was unwilling to surrender his rights and control over his church.
Right, and we have a case here that we can talk about that illustrates this really well. It's called the Battle Abbey case. Now, there's a canon that directs that abbots need to obey bishops. And this is the 8th decree of the 4th Ecumenical Council held at Chalcedon in AD 451. So they're really good at appealing back to things that are very, very old. So this is rarely where you have a dispute between an abbot who is the leader of a particular monastery and the bishop who rules the territory
around that
where the monastery takes place. And there's going to often be a clash between these things. Now, you might think that a clash between an abbot and a bishop would be thought of purely as an ecclesiastical matter, so nothing that the king needs to get involved in, but it wasn't seen that way. So in 1157, Hilary, Bishop of Chichester, challenged the right of the Abbot of Battle Abbey to have exemption from his authority. So the idea being there that Battle would not have to obey the bishop. It could kind of consider itself as kind of its own territory. This is the famous Battle Abbey case. Hilary's case was based on canon law, and Hilary was considered to be an expert in this. And a communication from Pope Adrian, and that is, of course, the only Englishman ever to be pope, who demanded that the abbot should attend a special hearing at Chichester to hear the pope's orders. Hilary argued that only a papal privilege could exempt a monastery from episcopal oversight, and that Battle Abbey had been granted no such privilege by any pope. Abbot appealed through the agency of his brother, Richard de Lucy, to the king. And very important, Richard de Lucy had kind of an important role in the royal court. So basically, the Abbot of Battle is using his family connections to try to get around his bishop's authority. In May of 1157, the trial dealing with the case was held in the presence of King Henry II at Colchester Abbey. The principal question was concerned with whether or not the Pope had the right to overrule the king on matters of religion in England. In the end, King Henry II decided the case between Hilary, Bishop of Chichester, and Walter de Lucy, Abbot of Battle Abbey, in favor of the abbot and his monastery's independence, which I don't think should surprise us at all, given the connection to his close courtier. The case turned on the written record. Abbot Walter produced royal charters granting the abbey its liberty from the jurisdiction of the regional bishop. Modern historians have cast doubt on the authenticity of the charters that the abbot's case was based on.
I am so shocked that a monastery would forge charters.
They're all forging. It would not be surprising if these were forgeries. Monasteries often forge charters for properties and rights that they somehow knew they had, but for which they lacked written evidence. This was a fairly standard procedure. But the authenticity of the charters really doesn't matter, as King Henry, during the case, personally validated their veracity. And at the time, everybody believed that they were genuine. So King Henry decided the case. And when Bishop Chichester protested, the king told him, basically, I put you in, I can push
you out. Becket, at the time, was the king's chancellor, and he acted as the abbot's lawyer in the case, defending the abbot in the liberty of Battle Abbey against the bishop. Because of the skill he displayed in this role as handling a potentially troublesome priesthood, it was said that Becket won over King Henry, and that Henry was so impressed with the chancellor's ability that he began to consider him to be the perfect candidate to succeed Theobald as Archbishop of Canterbury when Theobald finally died. Here was a person, the king thought, he could trust to protect his interests during the testing times of church versus state relations. So when Theobald died in 1161, Henry II chose Becket as Archbishop of Canterbury, which made him primate of the English Church. Becket's main qualification in Henry's eyes was that the Chancellor was loyal and devoted to him. He expected that Becket would continue to promote royal policy as Archbishop and be Henry's partner in administration of the realm as Theobald had been, and even better than Theobald. This was also what made him suspect to some other English prelates, in particular Bishop Gilbert Folliot, who expected that he should have been chosen as Archbishop. Becket, as Chancellor, had alienated many of the English bishops and abbots by demanding from them large donations, quote-unquote donations, so it's a little wonder that they opposed Henry II's decision to appoint him as Archbishop Theobald's successor. Against the will of the other bishops and the clergy and monks of Canterbury, in theory, bishops and archbishops are elected, but the reality was that the king's nomination was a powerful nomination. Becket was consecrated archbishop on 3 June 1162 after resigning the chancellorship.
At this time, bishops were technically freely elected by the clergy of the diocese over which they were to rule and acclaimed by the laity of the diocese. This was the result of the so-called investiture controversy that was supposed to free the clergy from the undue influence of powerful laymen. In 1122, the Concordat of Worms established the principle that bishops and abbots were to be freely elected and endowed with the symbols of their spiritual office by other clergy. But the Concordat acknowledged the right of rulers to endow prelates who held land and rights of jurisdiction from them to invest the newly elected bishops and abbots with the symbols of their temporal office. Bishops and abbots were expected to do homage and swear loyalty to the king in return for these endowments, which gave the kings a de facto veto power over the election of prelates. Moreover, since churches and monasteries depended upon royal favor, in particular in lawsuits, as we have seen, nobody wanted to alienate the king by choosing somebody whom the king disliked. The reality was that kings told churches and monasteries whom they should freely elect, and this was the case with Canterbury in 1162.
Well, we're running out of time, and we are doing this in two episodes, and we've gotten to the point that Becket has been consecrated as Archbishop, and we're leading up to the murder. The murder's been the shadow that's been hanging over this whole episode. Now, as soon as Becket was consecrated Archbishop, he seems to have become a completely different person. As Chancellor, Becket was accustomed to parading around in rich robes and cloaks. As Archbishop, we are told, he wore a hair shirt under his episcopal robes to mortify the flesh. As Chancellor, he lavished money on troubadours and courtiers. As Archbishop, he gave money to the poor. Why he changed, and whether that change was authentic, genuine, is a matter of historical debate. As Archbishop of Canterbury, Becket also was responsible for the financial welfare of his church, which meant safeguarding Canterbury's lands against encroachment by the knights who held land from it, and resisting the type of demands from the king that as chancellor he enforced on the other clergy. That's where we will be going in the next episode.
It's been really fun, Richard. I can't wait to see part two.
Yeah, in part two we'll finally get to Thomas's martyrdom and to the question of Henry II's complicity in it. But we will also be able to talk about a movie.
Absolutely.
Yeah. It was delightful having you again as my co-host and my guest, Jenny. And I'm looking forward to you coming back in a few weeks so we will continue and finish our story of Becket.
Looking forward to it.
Bye-bye for now.